Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
I could not be better. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing well. And this episode, Lance, it's such a fun conversation with an old friend of ours. His name is Todd Matthews, and he's been on the show before, which we kind of cover in this episode. And we recorded this a while ago, Lance.
Yeah, it became an unexpected controversial episode, certainly not in the subject matter that he spoke about. But I also want to get back to when he was originally on the show. We were connected to Todd through the author Deborah Halber. She wrote The Skeleton Crew, and part of The Skeleton Crew was about Todd Matthews and his introduction to the world of citizen sleuthing when he discovered the identity of Tent Girl.
And so we recorded this episode back in November, and we talk about the American Crime Fest a little bit that never happened.
What?
And Todd currently is working with the DNA Doe Project. So check them out on social media, the DNA Doe Project, and you can find links to their social media in our show notes.
And definitely make sure you check out their social media, because that is the department in which Todd is working for the DNA Doe Project.
And Todd found fame in the internet sleuthing community, and was in that book, The Skeleton Crew, that wonderful book, because he helped identify a Jane Doe named Tent Girl, who was found in Kentucky by his father-in-law. Sound weird? Well, we're going to break it all down with Todd in the interview.
Yep, he identified Barbara Ann Hackman Taylor nearly 30 years after his father-in-law, who was not his father-in-law at the time, found her body in 1968. So 30 years after 1998, just the beginnings of the internet. So this guy was really utilizing every tool possible in order to figure out the identity of Barbara Ann Hackman Taylor.
All right, so I hope you like the interview. Thanks a lot for listening. Welcome back to Crawl Space, Todd Matthews. How are you today, Todd?
I'm good. I'm good. We're enjoying a nice warm day and waiting for a blizzard tonight.
Old friend of the show, Todd Matthews.
Yeah. It's good to talk to you guys again.
Good to talk to you as well. When was the last time you were on? We're talking years now.
Yes.
I think it was last year, early last year.
You were one of the very first guests on Crawl Space. I want to say it was March of 2017.
Yeah.
Okay. It was still winter. I remember that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't currently living in the place that I'm living now. So it was at least 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That time flew by then.
Yep.
Yeah.
Time as it does.
As it does.
Yep.
And you were gracious enough to plan your trip to the American Crime Festival, where we were going to put on this festival, and it was going to be a grand old time, and it didn't happen.
And it was last weekend, and we had a great time, and your presentation was amazing. You got at least a 10-minute standing ovation, and then you and I enjoyed a cup of coffee out on the boardwalk.
What?
Oh, I can see it now.
During the sunrise.
unfortunately, it didn't work out that well, but I had two. There were so many forces trying to keep me from coming to that. So when it was canceled, it was like, okay, let's think of something. So I actually was going to try to get a plan B and meet a friend of mine that lives in New Jersey. And then I had a hernia, and I just got off hernia. I would not have physically been able to have taken that trip. So
oh, wow.
I feel better that it canceled me instead of me canceling it, because I had fairly fast planned surgery on Monday. And by Friday, I can't even lift 5 pounds right now. So,
wow.
See, it would have got me anyway. So that would have been unfortunate, because I couldn't have come in the pain that I was in, and certainly not post-surgery for a couple of weeks. So it was not meant to be.
Well, you sound good, so it sounds like you're recovering well.
And you had surgery last week, a week ago today?
It was a week ago today. And I had quite a few painful days and nights, and it's still a way away. But I'm done with the pain meds now. It's all just natural healing at this point. So it's okay, as long as I don't try to overdo it. You know, it's good.
You sent a funny email to us when we told you about the unfortunate cancellation of the ACF, and you said, I never pictured myself there anyway. You said, I booked the tickets and everything, but I never pictured myself there. And it made me think, with all the planning that we were doing, other than me on the boardwalk at dawn with a coffee.
Which never was going to happen.
Which Tim was right, never happened.
Yeah.
When you said that, I was like, oh, you know what? I really never pictured myself there either.
Well, usually if I'm going on a trip or something significant like it, I can preview in your brain of where you're going to be. I could not see myself there. So that was the funny thing. It's just like, something's going to happen. It's just not going to work out for some reason or another. I'm not going to be there.
I think Wildwood, New Jersey is too small for you anyway, Todd.
Yeah. That's big fish in a little pond.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's probably bigger than the little town I'm living in.
Yeah, but your gravitas is much larger than Wildwood could handle.
I couldn't imagine. I thought, why did they pick that spot? You know, no problem with Wildwood, but it was, I guess it just logistics made it the place to go. So, but I'd never been there, I don't think.
Yeah, it was kind of a longer story, but it was, it had to do with our partners in the venture where it was more convenient for them. It wasn't really our choice. In fact, we desperately did not want to have it in Wildwood, New Jersey. Again, no shade to Wildwood, but I think we just wanted an easier city to that people could travel to.
Slightly more accessible city.
Like Honolulu.
Oh, know. That'd be nice.
Honolulu was on the short list.
So what's new? What's been going on other than the hernia? And I'm sorry to hear about that. Glad you're recovering. But what's been going on?
So now my Facebook wall is full of mesh lawsuits.
Oh, no. What kind of lawsuits? That's
evidently, I Googled hernia trying to, you know, Google doctor myself. And now I'm getting all the banner ads for hire a lawyer to sue the people that put your mesh in for your hernia. And I thought, oh.
Yeah.
Something I do not want to hear right now. I don't want to hear about any failure problems with it. But now I actually had a very small office in the basement. It was never really exactly what I wanted. It was kind of like a corner of a closed off secure area at the basement. But just now this week, we're doing the final finish on the basement. So I'm finally going to have a room that's just my room, and it's not in the middle of anything. It's going to be completely secure with the door that will completely shut. So I have to go find a place to hide if I want to have a good conversation. So it's good. The bat cave is beginning, and it is literally the far back corner of the basement, completely underground. So it's a good spot. I'm really happy to get that done. So I'll be glad when I get better and I'm able to get up. I'm going to do some of the finish work on the walls and flooring, help with that. But I've got a handyman here now that's doing the drywall and the, you know, walling it in and doing all the drywall and some of the floor work. And my wife actually has a boutique in the basement too on the other side, and they've expanded that quite a bit bigger.
Oh, that's cool.
We hire our daughter-in-law to run that, so it's not even connected to my business at all. It's you can't even get into it the same way.
Now, you mentioned that it's the Bat Cave, and I'm trying to picture what is in Todd Matthews' bat closet. Is it?
Well, it's going to have some old stuff and new stuff. I've got stuff that are things that I've had for years, you know, that was great-grandparent stuff, you know, a few hand-me-down antique-type things that I want to put in there, and then, you know, some of the modern stuff, you know, I want to have some modern things, but I definitely am going to make the walls look cave-like on two of the walls that are exterior walls. I want to make them have that stony look, like they're really a cave. Not too tacky, but When tasteful. I say the bat cave, it's the bat cave.
Yeah, tasteful stone walls.
Yeah. Not. I don't want to look like somebody came here and thought, oh my God, this is a comic book person. It's like not, but it's enough that, you know, this is truly the bat cave. So hopefully this is my final resting place. Hopefully this is the last office I'll put together.
Oh my God.
And I can just finish out my life here.
Todd, you and your relationship with death is really just something that I don't know, gives me energy when I hear you talk about it and make jokes and things like so you're in a basement. Your work is in a basement. So is that comfortable yep. for you being underground? Since so much of your work has to do with
it's not a problem at all. It's the air. It's the climate. I like it. You know, it's cool, and it's just a very comfortable climate for me. I like a warm climate, tropical, but you know, you get hot, and this is, you don't really need air conditioning or anything. It just stays pretty much the same all year round back in this corner.
And is there a secret door in your backyard that you peel, like roll back the fake grass, and then the door's there, and you can access it that way?
I fantasize about that. I will say that. I would like to have a back door to get out of here where I could get out if I wanted to. I'd love to have that. But once I'm back in this little corner, it's fight or die. So it's whatever. If something comes at me, I'm going to kill you or it's going to kill me, one of the two. So.
I couldn't imagine anything wanting to attack you. That wasn't psychotic.
It'll be good, though, to finally get in a spot where I can just kind of curate my garbage and just have a spot.
Okay, Todd, so let's talk about Tent Girl. Tell us what that meant for you in your life. Was that a very big moment for you at that point?
Yes, yeah, Tent Girl definitely was. It was October of 1987, and my future wife of now 31 years walked into the high school with her sisters, and I noticed her right away. And I told my friend that was sitting right next to me, I said, that's a girl I'm going to marry. I was 17 and she was 16. I don't know why I said that, but Lori looked familiar. I felt like I'd known her forever. I mean, it was like seeing a ghost. I saw somebody that I knew, and I don't know why, and I still don't know why now. We still talk about that. And in study hall, she ended up in my study hall that afternoon. Of course, she gravitated over, and we started talking, and it was Halloween time of the year, so she started telling ghost stories, and she mentioned a body her father had found in 1967, 20 years earlier, and she was wrapped in a canvas tent wrapper, so she was known as the Tent Girl, as a Jane Doe. That story, when she told me that story, it sounded familiar. It sounded so familiar that it was like I could never stop thinking about it after that. I thought, I know this story. And then years into it, you become part of the story. So, and I still, that's been one of the most strangest twists that I've ever had, is the involvement in the Tent Girl and how it become part of our life, and now a daily part of our life. Because nothing that we see or do, our lives, our jobs, nothing is not something that sparked in light.
Yeah,
I can't tie anything back in my existence to it, something that had nothing to do with Tent Girl.
Amazing. So, okay, so Tent Girl was a Jane Doe that was found in Scott County, Kentucky in 1968
yes.
by Wilbur Riddle. And you were able to identify Tent Girl?
Well, authorities identified her. I'll say that I found evidence that supported that it could be a person. You know, I brought together what I thought to be a theory, and, you know, and I took it to law enforcement and took them 3 days to call me back. The only reason they called me back was because my father-in-law found the body, and they told me that, you know, it was like they would have nuts that would call over the years with just wild theories, psychics, everything. People would just call and, you know, and the name recognition gave me a callback. And my sister-in-law actually left the report because she still lived in Scott County. She told him to call me. She gave him enough information to know it was part of the family that had discovered the body. And that's why he called me back. And now we're good friends. You know, the former sheriff of Scott County, we all, you know, of course we're all friends now. We've done a TV show about 2 years ago, year before last, I think, Who Killed Jane Doe, and we recounted the story of the Tent Girl. And it's the first time that me, law enforcement, and the former sheriff and the family kind of all sat down together, got to flesh out their story a little more for a change. You know, Tent Girl, for the most part, was Todd and Tent Girl for, you know, years, 20 years now. But, you know, I always wanted to know a little more, and I wanted the public to know, who was Tent Girl? She was a mother, and we got to show that on that episode, and I think that was great.
yeah, I think that that's something that goes missing a little bit when you talk about, or when anyone talks about Tent Girl or any doe that is discovered, you know, any identity that's uncovered, you miss the history of that person. Can you tell us a little bit about who Tent Girl really was?
Well, she was Barbara Hackman Taylor. You know, she married a man. He had a false name. And yeah, I don't want to spoil it for everybody. They need to watch the Who Killed Jane Doe episode of the Tent Girl. But she married a man that wasn't who she thought he was. And one thing led to another. He traveled with the carnival. And then, unfortunately, we think that he killed her. And it never really can show on that episode specifically what happened. But we have recollections of the children that were present, the conversations they heard, the noises they heard. And it just, you can kind of put it together. And I never had a doubt when I saw the name, you know, and I found her on a website, kind of like Craigslist. It was called Crane and Hibbs. And I was looking, I got back up one night in January of 98. And I was looking for missing persons, and the internet was not like it is today. It was in no way like it is today. I mean, kids today would not understand the internet back then. It was a lot less pictures, very young, very primitive compared to today. And I was looking for missing sister, daughter, mother, anything, any kind of combination, just over and over and over, repeat, target in certain areas. If I thought it might be more likely she was missing from Kentucky, Lexington, I would focus on that area. And I saw her sister, Tent Girl's own family, her own sisters, they kind of recollected themselves. The girls had grown up, and they were looking for what happened to their mother. And so they had already started to collect on that end. So the presence was there. They were getting bigger, and they wrote a letter, kind of like you would have a missing dog. You would have a lost telephone and everything on this list. I saw my sister was last known to be alive in December of 1967 in Lexington, Kentucky. Give a big, brief description of her. That was her. Never had a doubt. That was the first time I picked up and said, that's her. And I've seen a lot of them where I looked at them twice. I said, no, that can't be. That person was seen past the point when this body was found. So I was going through all of that, why it can't be. That was the first time that I said, that's her.
How did you know?
That day, it was a feeling like none other. I mean, I've never felt like that ever, never before or after. It was just like a big weight lifted off, and it was like it was over. There was a lot of pressure with Tent Girl. There's a lot of, if I stopped looking for her because of financial or just hitting a wall and just getting tired of it, you know, I had such a terrible feeling, and I don't know how to describe it. You know, short of a haunting, it was guilt. It's like, you need to get back on this. I've never had anything pulled at me like that then. Nothing I've ever let get to me like that. When I saw that name and the contact information of how to get a hold of him, it was over.
Wow.
That heavy presence was gone.
So you said you felt guilty not working on it more?
Yes, if I stopped. Of course, I was in my 20s. I was just a dumb kid, and people didn't hesitate to tell you that. Or this is not natural. This is not healthy for you to be working on something like this. Let the cops deal with it. This is not your business. This is not your job. You get all of that. And it is, you know, it just get very frustrating. And long distance at the time, people today might not understand that you just didn't have an unlimited cell phone at the time. I've had phone bills back in the 90s of $200.
Yes.
And you're making just above minimum wage. You know, Lori wasn't happy about that.
Yeah.
She would call her mom. Her mom lived in Indiana. They moved to Indiana after they left here. And, you know, it was 10 cents a minute. So you had to like ration your telephone calls, you know, to try to call your mom, talk to her once a week. 10 minutes was, you know, it could start adding up really quickly. Hey, 10 cents a minute, 15 cents a minute. You know, we were shopping for whatever long distance we could get for the cheapest cost per minute.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't even think about it. It's unlimited.
Right. I know.
Yeah. And I think that's something that a lot of people have trouble wrapping their heads around, including myself, even though I was alive during that time and experienced that. But you just get so used to what you have at your fingertips now. And that's just like, you know, living your regular life. You, as a citizen, looking into this unidentified woman, I mean, now all of the resources you have, it feels unlimited. Back then, you're operating off of a landline with a primitive internet and, you know, staying up late at night to do this. What kept you, other than the guilt, like what kept you going?
I had a sense of commitment to her. I felt like, and you know, I think I've told you guys before, I had a brother and sister that passed that I was alive and witnessed it and knew it. You know, they died as infants, and one brother that's still alive, but I saw the impact on the family. But I can still go where they're buried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, at least I have that. And I thought, here I'm going to her grave in somebody else's place that can't be here. And then, you know, as the years passed, you know, when you're 20, you think you're going to live forever. And then you get close and you get, well, there might not be enough time for people to actually visit her grave and know what happened to her. So I can't just be a foster family member that'll visit the grave and pay respects. It's like, she needs to be where she's supposed to be. You know, and that was the whole thing. And I grew up a lot with that. You know, the obstacles that were in the way might not even exist today as obstacles, like the long distance and not having Google Maps to get there and take you right exactly to where a place is. You know, all of that stuff's been taken away for us. You know, there's a whole new set of obstacles now, you know, for things like that. But with her, it was just a matter of time. Time was ticking. And I just wanted her to be where she was supposed to be. She could at least be as well off as my brother and sister.
And you yourself went through a pretty significant health scare as a young child, right?
Yes, I had I had open heart surgery at 8. Now, I remember growing up, I'd always known I had a heart condition. So that was, you know, and usually we would go to Vanderbilt, and I paid attention more than most children did. And I could hear, you know, I heard the conversation. It didn't sound good. You know, I'd never expected to be an adult person. I could get that from the conversation. My mom and dad would try to be a little more discreet with it, but the doctors would use terms that they didn't think I understood, but I did. I did know that.
Yeah.
I remember going in for into the operating room. I wasn't asleep. They thought I was. I wasn't asleep. They had to fight me pretty hard, but one of the people rolling me said something about, said, this kid won't ever make it out of his teens.
Aw.
And you hear that, you know, that beats into your brain. It's like, I never expected to be alive today. I really didn't. I never had an idea of being a grandfather or anything like that. None.
This was a result of Agent Orange?
That's what we think. You know, Daddy had multiple illnesses from it. You know, there were some tumors. He's still alive today, and he's fought through all of it. But he was directly impacted with Agent Orange, and we never had any type of illnesses in our family that like this up until that point.
And that was in Vietnam. He fought in Vietnam.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Veterans Day of all days today. And he's still, I mean, I'm almost 50, and I've been fortunate to have both my mom and my dad with me all these years.
That's
and
great.
I've always been there for me to help me with anything I ever needed.
Did that experience and seeing your siblings and, then with Tent Girl, like, give you this perspective on death? Like, I've never seen anyone kind of joke about death. You almost, like, needle death, like, as if, like, death is, like, a friend of yours and you guys joke around.
He stops by, say, move not today. So, well, you do get a fondness, but you do get, it's an acceptance. I know it's going to be. I'm not happy about it, but it's like, it's going to be. I might as well accommodate life. I mean, if you plan on like, I'm never going to die, I'm never going to do this, never going to do that. I mean, that's not reality. That's living in a fantasy world. You are going to. There's nothing you can do about it. You know, prepare for it. In more ways than religious ways, you know, like I want to find out like what do I want to happen to this house after I die? You know, I built this house like nothing else I've ever done. We built it in a way that we could live out our lives here. We plan to live and die here. And, you know, I want it to be here for my kids. You know, I want them to be able to afford it. I want it to be paid off and be ready for them. So I think of things like that. I want to make sure this is completely paid for so that they can have a place to go to for the rest of their lives if they want to keep it. I'd like for it to be something that would stay in the family and not just something that's sold off later.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, with Tent Girl and your work on that case, do you think any part of that was you trying to impress Lori?
No, because it didn't. It didn't impress her. That's the whole thing. It did when it was over. You know, it did. And it certainly does now, because she realized that was my college.
Yeah.
I just didn't know it. It was my college, and you struggle in college, and I struggled with Tent Curl. It wasn't easy.
But that wasn't your motivation at the time.
No, I felt a personal obligation to it. I mean, it's like I knew Lori and I knew Tent Curl, but not necessarily together. If that makes sense, it's like two individuals that I've encountered that I feel an incredible pull toward. And it wouldn't, you know, I don't want to say it, nothing like it. You hear of love at first sight. It was more than that. I mean, it was like I knew her. It was just like you just woke up and you recognize somebody you didn't know yesterday. I know her. That's the person I'm supposed to stay with till the end.
What were you doing professionally while you were looking into Tent Curl?
Well, I went to work at the factories. You know, we started out, garment factory was the first thing here, and that the garment industry's gone from here now. But just sorting bundles and that type of thing, working in a cutting room, that didn't last very long. I'd worked in a grocery store and I met Lori. I was working part-time for my uncle. And then you had to get a big boy job then. So we both went to work for a garment factory. We worked together because there was always some kind of need that we needed to be kind of close together. I don't know. I just always felt like we needed to be somewhere within arm's reach of each other. And so we tried that. And I ended up going to Hutchinson. It's an automotive factory. And I spent 20 years there before all of this blew up, you know. Things had to evolve from Tent Curl. You know, once identification was made, there were several years later that a little growing up had to happen, you know, and it had to set in, you know, and people got to hearing about Tent Curl, and it kept reverberating. The same problem would come up with unidentified, and they'd say, but wait, the internet did this for this one. How can we do that? So it kept bringing people back to me, and I would engage with them. Even single opportunities with medical examiners. It's like, I want to put this on Donate Work, and we would help them. We would do it. We would put their case up and at least get the word out. You know, we didn't even have a handle on how many John or Jane Does were out there. It was like they were just randomly, and you know, nobody had really tried to coalesce something together to have an idea of who these are. And once you start putting them together, the Samuel Little things start to pop out, you know, the trends, like, wow, seven of these were redheaded and were strangled. You know, that's when we were able to start putting together trends and things like that, to figure out, like, wow. And I remember telling law enforcement, like, we would say something very similar, just a far enough distance apart that word of mouth wouldn't have shed a little light on it, and just say, hey, you know, there's another body just like that one in this area. And there was one with Tent Curl too, one in Pennsylvania, a girl had been put in a bag, and we think that it was unrelated. But I don't know that. I don't know for a fact. Candace Clothier, I don't really know that it was unrelated.
Does the thought of, like, a serial killer in any one of these cases cross your mind? It must, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. And you see things, and you know, and sometimes it may or may not be something of any significance. Sometimes it's just coincidence, but then other times it can be more.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about, not to regress in the conversation, but the relationship between you and your father-in-law, was that strained at all due to your investigation into Tent Curl, because that was his case, that was his story?
Yeah, it kind of was. I think when I was working on it, he didn't understand what I was doing in the first place. He thought I'd ask a lot of questions, and he was happy enough to be the person to answer your question. But when I identified her, he said, you know, it's like, well, I found her. It's like, well, yeah. But you see in a lot of these cases today, it's what he didn't understand. Like, a lot of these John and Jane Does found by passerby. You know, so he didn't get that. You know, it was like the fact that I identified her as his son-in-law reinforced him, his own role. So it's like he was fighting against me. It's like, this reinforced you because now it's part of your family that helped resolve us as a team. We were on both ends of this. It made him more significant, but he never didn't really see that. He saw that I was getting opportunities and accolades for things that he didn't. And he couldn't have done. I mean, he couldn't have done anything with the internet. There was nothing he could have done. And you don't get a set on the payroll because you found Tent Curl. You don't. I mean, I don't think he understood what I had to do. You know, like right now, what I do on a daily basis doesn't directly have anything to do with the Tent Curl other than proximity of putting me here.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with it. But it's the things I learned from helping resolve that case.
So what did you, is there any like strategy that you applied during your Tent Curl search that is still relevant today in this age where the internet has moved forward so far?
Well, I think it was one of the first times somebody took a Jane Doe and put her on the internet as a wanted poster type of thing. It might have been the first time. But that was a, you know, that idea seemed strange at first. And then Clark County, Nevada did more than that. They actually put morgue photos. And I was a little appalled at that. You know, I met Matt Murphy. He was the coroner there. And I thought, maybe the facial approximations are better for John and Jane Doe's instead of the horrible death scenes that you don't want families to remember. But as a coroner, he reminded me of something. It's the same as when you have to pull that sheet back for somebody to make an identification in the morgue. We're just doing it electronically. So he was right. You know, it was like, sometimes you can't sugarcoat them. Now, I worked a lot with forensic artists. We created a forensic artist project called Project Eden, and it still goes today. You know, it's volunteer professional artist. And a lot of times we would take some of the real morgue photos and maybe take away some of the trauma. You know, maybe not do a full reconstruction, but maybe just take away some of the trauma, because you know good and well, if you have a deceased loved one, you might not recognize them if you saw them. You know, my uncle passed away, he had a heart attack, and they took off his glasses and they took his teeth out. I wouldn't have known him.
Yeah,
I would not have known him. So I didn't want people to overlook them too fast, because a lot of times with forensic art, they're taking away that trauma, but it is a completely new picture, and it can be from a skull or part of a skull. So you're, you know, it's an approximation. But if we took the real ones, it's like, okay, so this one has a little bit of blood in the nose. Can I take away the blood?
Yeah.
To at least spare that. So, you know, that's the thing. At least spare that memory. And it's worked. You know, I've worked a lot with Arizona, Bruce Anderson in Pima County. I can't tell you how many photographs he sent that we've just took away a wound or a bruise or just took the swelling down just a little bit. And all of this is outside of NamUs. This is what I was doing before NamUs. Now, the NamUs strategy, you know, I'm working in marketing and looking for ways to promote NamUs more so than in the field today. But, you know, that doesn't, you know, you'll get a case, you'll have people, your family that'll call and they're trying to search a database, and you help them, you see things, and, you know, it's hard to get away from that. It's like when a cop retires and goes and does something in his retirement that's kind of like a consultation type business. It's hard to get away from that when that's in your nature.
And how do you handle all the fame and fortune and, you know, frankly, the women? Like, how do you handle all of that?
Oh, you just got to run faster.
Do you have any plans to write a book about your experience? Or maybe, you know, can we see this, the Todd Matthews story starring
Willem Dafoe
is Todd Matthews.
Well, you know, most people do write a book when they're done with their professional career. So, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, say, it just seems huge right now to think about that. But I think everybody should at least document some of the things that occurred during that pathway, just to let people know. And I get a lot of opportunities to work on scripted and non-scripted. Can't say who, but I do have somebody that's very interested in a scripted program with me right now that would, it'll be about kind of the people that we were during the upheaval of Tent Girl, that type of thing. And I got called on a lot of different things. It wasn't always missing and unidentified during those years right around the Tent Girl and after. It was unsolved homicides. There were so many offshoots that people were trying to apply the same thing. Like, well, you could do this with information. Can you do that? And sometimes you could. Put information out there and get feedback from the public. I mean, I'd literally have people come into the house, a news article about we're working on this case. We're not sure if it was a homicide or not. And I'm just trying to help law enforcement gather more details. Have people come into the house and they would tell you, here's what I know about it. Here's what I know about that. And they didn't always want to talk to law enforcement, but they would talk to me.
And I think one of the burning questions that people probably have at this point is, when are we going to hear the Todd Matthews podcast on the Crawl Space Network?
I would be too busy right now, but I did that. I did Missing Pieces for a while back in 2006 and 2007. I did 100 episodes, and ironically, some of the people that I interviewed for that turned out later to be people that were very relevant in this world, like Jan Smolensky and Mike Murphy. He's a coroner. Jan Smolensky is the mother of a Billy Smolensky, a missing adult from Connecticut. The Help Find the Missing Act at the national level that we're broke off into state level now was originally based on her son.
Wow.
So it was, you know, that original narrative is what we used. It didn't pass nationally. And I think it was easier to pass at a state level when you could customize it for the states. So it's just a little longer in process. But some of those people were the people that I met along the way. And, you know, I think a podcast would be great, but it'd be really deep in the weeds for me right now.
How about re-releasing those episodes that you already did? So we can start there.
Now there should be some still there that you can see on missingpieces.info. What we did, we transcribed them. Back in the day, the internet was harder to search. So even back in that time period, I had volunteers that would transcribe the episodes so that you could read them, and they were available in searches. So that's been a good thing. Some of the original audio I've lost. Some of them, we'd literally tape it over the telephone and upload it, and we took some down at people's request. I've had a lot of television shows that are doing specials on some of these cases now, and they want to license the audio or the clip of the actual episode. And, you know, that's always a yes. If somebody wants that, you know, take it. That's why it's there.
Yeah.
Please reference my show. You know, that's great, you know. So I'm not going to get in a complicated contract with somebody to license a small clip of something that I put there for that purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, so if you can see it, you can use it.
Right.
That's what I usually tell people. So, you know, I want to make sure it's something the family would appreciate happening. And sometimes it's a clip of somebody interviewed that are now deceased, and that's the only audio they might have had of that person.
Right. And that's why we always tell everyone no. Who asks to use anything from us, we say, you get your own interview.
Get your own interview.
Yeah, you do yourself, yeah.
Or you fork over some money.
Well, you send us a 10-page contract and a big, thick check.
I didn't know the value. See, and I was building something then. Again, it was something I built that I didn't know there was going to be an invested value in.
Right.
I didn't know that. I didn't know it would have any value to it.
What's it like being so,
humble,
ahead of your time? I mean, you are a man ahead of his time. You had a podcast before they were a thing. You were a citizen detective. You're a superhero, and you're yes. I just got my little basement here.
I just hope that I've done something now that I'll realize in a couple of years is really good, really cool. Because I'm running out of tricks now. So, you know, life has changed though when you you know, a lot of the focus now is on grandchildren. You know, it's that type of thing. A lot of it is what kind of legacy are you going to leave for them? And you know, the struggles of raising children and grandchildren is a lot of focus. So I feel like we lit a lot of fires back in the day, but there's finally the day that it's like, I ain't got nothing left. You know, it's I've thought of everything I could think of. I think now, just maybe like you said, the book and documenting some of the everything that happened in between. And some of the crazy things that happened, like with just ironically, and I just don't know how some of the things that have happened to me have happened without some sort of orchestration that I did not do.
Understood.
I was too young and didn't know how.
Understood.
I mean, us crossing paths at the right time, you meet somebody that you knew, and now we work together here. Now we both work in the house. She works from home. Past 10 years, we both work from home. So again, we're together.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, so the universe is clearly delivering some messages.
It put us right back.
Yeah, and delivering some messages to you, and you're receptive to them, and you don't overanalyze the why. You just move with the task at hand, and it typically ends in something positive and something productive happening in the future.
Always has. I mean, there's no struggle we've been through that we didn't get paid back 10 times over. And it's like the universe picked us up and used us and now put us in a happy little spot, and it's just like, okay, you're good. You're okay. You guys have got jobs that are not physically difficult to do. Mentally they are, but as long as we're sharp in the brain that we can do it. And you can earn a good living. You can be close to your family. You're together. Okay, I'll take it.
Well, hearing you puts me in a good spot.
Well, I have to talk myself into this every now and then too. So
yeah,
it is, everybody has depression, you know, and I have people that said you're always so upbeat, and it's like, that's the treatment.
Yeah.
You know, I read a book, something with Lucille Ball years ago, and it says behind the laughter, you know, there was a lot of struggles going on behind that laughter, but laughter is truly the best medicine. I can laugh myself into something. There's times where you feel really down and just about everything, like getting older and your parents are getting older and you got to find a buddy or somebody that you always laugh with and just find the funny things and laugh at it, you know, as much as you can. Make fun of something that deserves it, and then just laugh it out. And there's always somebody that deserves it. So there's no shortage of that.
Yeah.
Yep. Lance does deserve it.
And even us, you know, you make fun of each other or yourself. It's the best thing. You know, if I get offended, I just won't talk to myself for a week or so. So that's good.
Is there a particular tent girl that you're working on now that you would like to see brought to a conclusion?
No, I can't have favorites with this, but I mean, there are, you know, some that are close to you that are physically, geographically close to your area, you do wonder, because you wonder about, like, I probably walked up that trail, or that person, what if they were right here? You know, it's just natural human curiosity on those things. You see them. There was a case from the late 90s from Campbell County, Tennessee. It was the first case that we did a facial reconstruction for. It was a Jane Doe shot through the skull. And, you know, I had her skull for a period of time. I took it to a forensic artist and literally had a skull in a duffel bag. My first skull in a duffel bag. So when you get this close to seeing things dead, the part that most people don't get to see, that behind the scenes, you know, you get a little used to it. You get more comfortable with it. It's like, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
So you might as well know as much about it as you can. It doesn't have to be the great unknown completely. It's just what's going to happen next. And I think we have a realistic approach to it. I dread it more than anything with my mom and dad. But, I mean, we're having conversations like, okay, so not like wheels and things like that. It's like, okay, how are we going to carry out this structure when you're not part of it? What do you want? Mm-hmm. How do you want us to do this? So it's not like dividing your goods up so much. It's like your will. What is it? What would you like to see happen with this family should you not be part of it? And we've had these conversations. I have one with my brother quite often, you know, like, well, what do you want to do? And how are we going to preserve this? And how are we going to make sure this stays this way for as long as possible? You know, and how do we instill this in our children? Mark has no children. I got two boys and two grandsons. It's like, and he's there for me. How are we going to instill these beliefs and good things in these kids so that they'll believe it? They won't just do it because we tell them to. They do it because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
That's things we think about.
Does your family ever take you aside and they're just like, geez, Todd, like, stop with the death. Stop with the death talk.
No, not usually. It's such a reality. So we don't approach it in a way where it's so dark. It's just like, okay, so we're going to think about this now. What are we going to do with this? Or if my dad has a project, it's like, you realize I'm not going to be able to maintain this for you. Like, he's got tractors. I don't drive tractors. I can't drive tractors. So it's like, I'm not going to have all these tractors probably to rot down around me.
Yeah.
What do you want me to do with them? You know, I don't want to just sell them or something. But my oldest son seems to have a mechanical ability. So I think he will be our next person that will handle, because we need these. I mean, we got about 8 to 10 acres here. We kind of need them, but it's too late for me to learn how to do any of that. And I'm certainly not going to work on them.
If we send you some crawl space decals, can you put them on the side of the tractors and they can be your crawl space tractors?
I could, and take a picture of it.
That'd be awesome.
I will send it to you.
Done.
Perfect.
I'm living in my crawl space now.
There you go. Everything comes together. The universe is literally...
It's conspiring in our favor.
Screaming and conspiring at us. Yes.
Well, it's coming. And things like this come. Something just taking times to reflect on things like this, talking to you guys, something to pop up.
Yeah.
You'll see. Something to pop up. I mean, usually I'll get some movement on a project. Just because I think that I focused on it and cleansed my mind a little bit, took the normal daily things out and just had a conversation. It was kind of fun, you know? You don't get to do this every day.
This is a question that I've never asked anybody, but I'm, for whatever reason, very curious about in regards to you. What's a Todd Matthews dinner look like? What's your favorite thing for dinner?
Well, I'm trying to do low carb now.
Okay.
Now, what I would really like is mashed potatoes. It's bread. Bread for me is the thing that I can't eat. The carbs, I can't eat. If I stop eating the carbs, I can eat everything else I want and not gain any weight if I dump the carbs.
Well, the carbs,
that is my enemy, is the carb. Yeah. And that is the thing that I want more than anything is bread. I could eat a mashed potato sandwich. I would love it. But today I'll probably get a hamburger with no bun. If I'm on the boat or here, if we have like a calzone or something with bread on it, unless I throw the bread in the water immediately, I will eat it later.
You have a boat?
Yeah, we have a small house, but we stay on that on the weekends through the warm months. It's they're like 36-foot, just small little boat. But in fact, the premise of one of the scripted shows was going to put somebody living on a houseboat working on some of these crimes. And the name of my boat is Suspicious Minds.